Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Guardians of the Holy Grail, a program which is dedicated to diving deep to uncover and expose the truth behind the ancient Holy Grail mysteries. My name is Marco Amato Pinkham, and I'll be your host for this show. The Guardians of the Holy Grail was created by me in order to clear up many of the popular misconceptions regarding the Holy Grail mysteries, the Knights Templars, the Freemasons, and the other secret societies that are currently floating around the internet and talked about within certain academic and lay communities. I'm hoping to set the record straight with this show, with hard facts from authors and researchers, as well as with testimonials from current and past members of the Knights Templar, Freemasonry, and other secret societies. I myself am a Knight Templar of the International Order of Gnostic Templars, which was founded to revive the mystical rites and wisdom of the original Knights Templar that over the centuries have either been lost or ignored. Our Gnostic Knight Templar organization is both a mystical order, wherein we practice both alchemy and gnosis, as well as a research organization dedicated to finding the truth behind the mysteries of the Knight Templar, Holy Grail, and secret societies. You can learn more about us by visiting our website, which is www.gnostictemplars.org. Now, this show is dedicated to answering everyone's questions. And so if you have one during the show that you would like to ask our guest, please feel free to call our toll-free number at 888-815-9756. Well, today we have a very important guest on, very interesting guest, and he'll be familiar to many of you. His name is Christopher Knight. He's a internationally best-selling author and researcher who writes about the mysteries of Freemasonry, the Knights Templar, and other secret societies. Through his travels and research, Christopher has uncovered many secret mysteries related to the origins of Freemasonry, the Knights Templar, as well as the Essenes, the Shroud of Turin, sacred geometry, and even Roslyn Chapel. I'm sure that many of you have read about his discoveries in his very popular books, some which he co-wrote with Robert Lomas. These are the Hiram Key. I'm sure that's familiar to many of you. Uriel's Machine, The Second Messiah, and the Book of Hiram. On his own, Christopher has also written Solomon's Power Brokers, and his new book, which is coming out in October, will be Before the Pyramids. And we'll be talking about that during this interview. Now, I was fortunate to meet Christopher a few years ago when he spoke at a Holy Grail conference I organized in Glastonbury, England. Since then, he's become an honorary knight of our temple organization, and he'll be representing us, as well as all Templars around the globe, at the International Congress to Unite the Secret Societies, which will take place next April in Osimo, Italy. So greetings, Christopher. Welcome to the Guardians of the Holy Grail.
Thank you very much. Good to speak.
Well, like everybody else out there, I've got a lot of questions for you. You began researching when you became a Freemason way back in 1976. Now, what made you join Freemasonry at that time, and what exactly were you looking for?
Well, the whole point about Freemasonry is you're supposed to sort of sign up for it without knowing what it's about. You know, it's a strange thing in this day and age. You join a club, but you don't know what the club's for. But the reason I joined, I was sort of 25 when I was looking at it, 26 when I joined. That's 33 years ago now. And I'd heard some very negative things about Freemasonry, and yet I knew two or three older guys that seemed very honorable and part of society, and I thought, I wonder what it is they get up to. And I thought, well, there's only one way to find out. I'll apply to join. If it's really weird, I can leave and nothing's spoiled. So I joined, and it was every bit as weird as I thought, and did my first degree, and second degree, and third degree over a year. And, you know, I said to them, these rituals are seriously weird. You know, where do they come from? And I just get a response that, don't worry, young man, you'll find out in due time. Just carry on, learn the ritual, and all will be well. And slowly, after 2 or 3 years, I realized I hadn't a clue what it was about. And so I thought, I've got to find out about this. So I started reading lots of old books, the older the better, from earlier Masonic researchers, early Victorian period and beyond. And it started me on a long, long journey of discovery that ended 20 years afterwards with the publication of The Hiram Key. Because I thought, well, this deserves to be put into a book. And I spoke to Robert Lomas about it, and he agreed to help. And I thought, well, you know, a few people might buy it. And now it's sold over 1 million copies in 40 languages. And I just still haven't quite got over the fact that so many people were interested in it, really.
Well, why do you think it was that so many people gravitated to your book? It was just like this massive worldwide bestseller.
But I found it incredibly humbling, actually, because, first of all, I didn't expect it to do so well. I mean, the UK, in 3 days sales, it went right to the top 10, and it stayed there for month after month after month. And I got probably thousands of letters and letterly emails from people saying how important it had been to them. A few, and just literally a handful, were aggressive, but 99.9% were supportive. I think a lot of Freemasons wanted to know where the order had come from, and my digging around and speculation was helpful, whether they fully accepted what I said or not. Some did, some did in part, and that's fine. But also, I think because I was digging into, by necessity, into the origins of Judaism, the development of Judaism, I spent, you know, nearly 20 years just reconstructing the development of Judaism for personal interest, so that I could understand the mindset of the people that I'd come to believe had buried scrolls under the Temple of Jerusalem. And that took me also into the origins of Christianity. And so I think probably more people were interested in what I was saying about the origins of Christianity than anything else. And I was getting people, you know, from all over saying, this has helped me get sort of three-dimensional vision for at last on my belief. And it's been really helpful. So, you know, it's incredibly humbling, really. Some people said, this has changed my life. You think, my God, how's a book done that? So I think a lot of people read it for Freemasonry, but I think a lot more just read it because they wanted to make sense of how everything worked together. And interestingly, good half of those people that wrote were women. And of course, most Freemasons are not women. In the US, there is the Eastern Star, but so it appealed across the board, I think.
Well, yeah, when I was first planning to form the International Order of Gnostic Templars, or to revive that organization, I actually put out on the internet that what my plans were, and I got this. I also got a huge response from that. I remember, but as it turns out, about 90% of those people that seemed to be interested were women. So it's interesting. Yeah. And I think we probably have more women in our organization today too because of that. Well, do you think that your work with the Hiram Key has really fundamentally changed Freemasonic history? Do you think that it's actually being accepted and taught in some of the lodges?
Well, it certainly is in some. I mean, it's a great big machine to dent, and I don't think it's easily sort of steered off course. The United Grand Lodge of England, which positions itself as the premier lodge, without good reason in my view, says that we can't know anything about Freemasonry prior to 1717, which is a completely political situation driven by the war between England and Scotland and the fact that Freemasonry was Scottish in origin. And they refused to look beyond that other than to make a few sort of, well, perhaps it was something to do with stonemasons. But yet, a lot of good friends of mine around the world, very senior Freemasons, 33rd degree Freemasons, in the US certainly, I was saying that they're increasingly seeing my thoughts being quoted in academic works, that it is slowly but surely infiltrating into the system. I mean, clearly, it doesn't have to be 100% right, but it's unlikely to be 100% wrong. So it was a speculative investigation. It was a story of my personal investigation, and a surprising amount has it surprises me at least, has proven to be reasonably accurate over the years. I expected a lot more to sort of crumble as people came out and said, no, there's some evidence here that says you're wrong and wrong here. That hasn't really happened. Who knows exactly which bits are completely right, which parts are partially right, which parts are completely wrong. But I think the great thing, in retrospect, is that it got everybody talking and everybody looking and everyone agreeing that, of course, Freemasonry didn't suddenly materialise out of the blue, fully born in 1717. It's a great deal older than that, and I mean, a huge amount. Originally, I thought maybe we'd go back to 1500, maybe 1400, but, you know, I'm back thousands and thousands of years now, so it keeps going backwards in time.
Well, I know, I remember a big part of the Hiram Key related to the Knights Templar. What did your research turn up about that organization?
Well, they sprang up pretty early on because there was no, as I was following it back, I mean, in Masonic ritual, it explains that the rituals of Freemasonry came from the Knights Templar. I mean, it states that. And it also states where they got them from. So at first I thought, well, this has got to be poetic license. But I realized that it had to be true that those nine knights that dug beneath the Temple of Jerusalem after the First Crusade between 1118 and 1128, they found something really, really important that turned them from paupers to the richest people the world had ever known overnight. So they were clearly a linchpin, and what they had dug under the temple and recovered documents which apparently had made them fabulously rich and apparently had given them all sorts of scientific information about building and making these soaring cathedrals of Europe and starting the international banking system and trade and commerce, and they kicked off the Industrial Revolution in actual fact with trade across countries between wool and textile manufacture, and what they achieved was sensational. So what was in these documents they dug up? So we know that according to the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were found in the desert in Qumran in 1947, that all of those documents that were found had copies that were put underneath the temple just prior to 70 AD, when it was destroyed by Titus, by the Romans, plus a lot more, and treasures. And they named the huge amounts of treasures they buried there and the documents. And they said where they were buried, but they were the descriptions were only descriptions that people in the know would understand. They were not easy to follow at all. So that's why I then spent the best part of the next 20 years reconstructing the mindset of the people that put the documents there to try and work out what was important to them, where would they have got their knowledge from, what things did they believe. And then that would help me understand what the Knights Templar had recovered. Now, at the time, I thought it was a hopeless task, but it was just then a personal voyage of discovery. I had no intention of writing a book. So I just put the hours in, and for year after year, reading obscure documents and looking for translations that I can understand and building up a picture of the mindset of these people, and wow, they were impressive. Astonishing. And then started to understand the difference between Enochian Judaism and Mosaic Judaism and Rabbinical Judaism, as we have today, which is completely different, and early Christianity and Christianity 200 years later and modern Christianity. Suddenly you get an understanding and a flavor of what's going on. It's just, it was fascinating, and it allowed me to speculate as to what was happening. But right in the center of this is the Knights Templar, and I'm now utterly convinced that they were Jewish priests' families that would come down the line from the time of Solomon, quite literally. These families have become powerful in Europe, and tracking down day by day records of individuals and their movements, which you can do to an amazing extent, you start to build a picture of what they were trying to achieve. And in fact, the whole First Crusade was conceived not to liberate Jerusalem from the Muslims for the sake of Christianity. It was to recover their documents and their treasures from under the temple. And these families that were so influential in Europe, even to the Pope at the time, Pope Urban, he was one of them. You know, they entered the church to take control. And it's quite astonishing what they achieved. I mean, they fought amongst themselves, and that didn't do them a lot of good. But originally, a lot of this is explained in Masonic ritual. Originally, I thought, well, this is just myth and legend. But actually, a great deal of myth is based on fact, and that is the case here. So the Knights Templar are absolutely a Jewish priestly concept, but not in any sense, in the modern sense of Judaism, in a very ancient Enochian manner.
Would you equate these Jewish families you're referring to as the Rex Deuce families that Tim Wallace Murphy writes about?
Yeah, well, I in The Second Messiah, I took Tim's description, because for sure he was touching on part of this same. He'd come in from a completely different direction, but he was touching on the same strand very much. I now call them the star families because their symbol was the five-pointed star, the George Washington's family, and he was certainly one of them, on his crest, and which was transferred onto the flag of the United States, and so forth. So I call them star families because the sign of the star, which is the Holy Shekinah, which was the Temple of Jerusalem, was designed for the light of the Shekinah to shine into, with a fantastic cycle of 1,440 years, which was actually Mercury and Venus in conjunction rising, which was also the Star of Bethlehem as it happened. And that they knew that it would appear three times within that 1,440 years, be 480 years. Cycle. And they wrote about this, and they explained it in the star prophecy, and they said the Messiah would arrive as the Holy Shekinah came next, and it would deliver the Jews from the yoke of the enemy, which at that time, of course, was the Romans. Before that, it had been the Persians, and they'd always had their difficulties. But the symbol of the star is the thing that takes them right back. So I call them now the star families, but Tim Wallace Murphy's Rex Deus is describing pretty much the same thing, I think.
Well, have you come across anybody in Europe that would claim, that do claim, that they're part of a Rex Deus family or one of these star families?
No, they tend to do the opposite, if at all. Tim Wallace Murphy claims that he did come across one who admitted to it and explained to him that he didn't quite understand it, but his father had told him when he was 21 that he was part of these families, and that he had to pass it on to his son when his son was 21, and so forth. And that actually does bear out with other bits of evidence around the Sinclairs of Roslyn and the cadet side of the family that has now got the earldom. So Tim may have genuinely come across one, I think, but I never have. I'm not sure, for sure they're still there, but I suspect, and it's only a suspicion, that in this day and age they are not necessarily all family. They are also introducing certain people of a like mindset, and they are immensely powerful, and I mean, you know, in Washington, D.C., immensely powerful. And I've spent the last 20 years sort of denying that such things exist, and suddenly I've had a change of my mind.
Well, since you wrote after you wrote the Hiram Key, you wrote the Second Messiah, And in that book, you claim that the Shroud of Turin is not really the image of Jesus. It has the image of Jacques de Molay. You know, how did you come upon that conclusion?
Just a wealth of evidence, a massive wealth of evidence. It was completely accidental. I have no interest in the Shroud of Turin particularly, and certainly didn't set out to solve its mystery or anything else. It's just the circumstances of the arrest of Jacques de Molay and Geoffrey de Charnay, who were arrested together in the Paris Temple on the 13th of October 1307 when the French authorities descended upon the order en masse. And, of course, they tortured them horribly, to extract confessions, and they were well known for nailing people up to doors on the nearest object. It's a great piece of torture. I mean, crucifixion has never been a form of execution, as most people imagine. It is a form of torture. People in the last days, as they struggle to breathe and with their arms stretched back. They were certainly told that they couldn't kill Jacques de Molay or Geoffrey de Charnay because they had to stand trial, but they didn't have to be too gentle in extracting confessions. And, of course, they were accused of denying the divinity of Christ and the power of the cross, amongst other things. But those are the two things that they didn't deny. They denied homosexual activity, but interestingly, they didn't deny those two things. But when you look at the fact that the Shroud of Turin first was discovered in a chest in the home of the de Charnay family, the direct descendants of Geoffrey de Charnay, and the mechanism for the image itself, now the carbon dating is bang on that. You know, it was said to be between 1119 and 1128, which of course, it's between, gosh, my memory's going. It was about 50 years either side of 1307. So the carbon dating is accurate. The weave is a typical French weave of that period, certainly not a weave that's ever been knowingly used at the time of Christ anywhere. The image itself is very peculiar because it's formed by scorches that are only on the absolute molecular tip of the fibers. And, of course, it's negative. It appears to be a Volkringer effect. That is, when someone's horribly tortured, like Jacques de Molay, nailed to a door, he's told he's got to confess. He doesn't confess to the things that they want him to confess. They take him down and they wrap him in the shroud in a mock way because, I mean, he denied the power of the cross and the divinity of Christ. So how appropriate to crucify him, wrap him in the shroud, and then leave him and send to the de Charnay family to come and take care of him, because he had no relatives of his own in France. But Geoffrey de Charnay did. So the lactic acid on a person that's tortured like that will be flowing. And what that does is it strips the oxygen molecules, O2, into oxygen singlets, O1, which are completely unstable. And just for a millisecond, they leave the body, and when they hit the shroud, they release energy as they I'm not a chemist or physicist, but this is what I'm told. They recombine to form O2, which is stable, normal oxygen. But the release of energy scorches the tip of the fabric, and where the cloth is closer to the body, there are more impacts, so it goes darker. Where it's further away, there are less, so it's lighter. So you get a negative image. But the thing about the Volkringer effect is it takes 50 years for the image to be visible. They wouldn't see it initially. And it was 50 years in a chest in the de Charnay family before they pulled it out and said, hey, look at this, there's an image on here. And so they sold it to the church to raise money because they were very short of cash at the time. And the church denied it was anything of any significance whatsoever for a while. And then they decided, well, actually, it might be more useful if we did say it was the image of Christ. But they knew full well what it was, in my view. Therefore they went along with it. But it's just 10 years ago since I did a public debate in the Orkney Science Festival on whether it was indeed the image of Jacques de Molay or the image of Jesus Christ, and won hands down on the argument. And it, it remains today the only theory, the only explanation of the Shroud that takes all known facts into account. There are many theories, but none of the others have got the location, the reason, the science, the history, the motivation. So whether it's true or not, and another key point is, of course, the image on the Shroud, if you look at it, it's not someone in their early 30s. It's someone in about age 60, which Jacques de Molay was, of course. It just isn't a young man.
Well, a lot more food for thought. Well, we're going to take a short break now and come back with Christopher Knight. We're going to talk about his latest book, Before the Pyramids, and I guess I hear some of that has to do with the secret Freemasonic conspiracy, so you're not going to want to miss that. So we'll be back in a moment. Don't go away.
BBSRadio.com. If it's not mainstream, it could be here. Information and knowledge, bringing humanity closer to truth. BBSRadio.com. In our Constitution, the Founding Fathers laid a path to an economy that should have kept Americans free and prosperous. How we the people were tricked off that path into a world of debt and deception reads like one of the great mystery novels of all time. American Free Press compares author Ellen Brown's new book, Web of Debt, to an eye-opening thriller that will leave you feeling like Neo in the Matrix. In Web of Debt, the mysterious and often shocking origins of today's ultimate financial crisis are exposed, starting with its distant beginnings to its present disastrous climax as the reader is shown that the way to restore America's true wealth has been with us all along. Please visit Ellen Brown's website, webofdebt.com, to see how America's money and future can become by and for the people once again.
Attention, an important product from hempusa.org, microplant powder, will change your life by removing all types of positive toxins, such as heavy metals, parasites, bacteria, viruses, and fungus from the digestive tract and stomach wall so you can absorb nutrients. Microplant powder is 89% silica and packed with a negative charge that attracts positive toxins from the blood, organs, spine, and brain. This product has the ability to rebuild cartilage and bone, which allows synovial fluid to return to the joints. Silica is a precursor to calcium, meaning the body turns silica into calcium and is great for the heart. There is no better time than now to have microplant powder on your shelf or in your storage shelter. And with an unlimited shelf life, you can store it anywhere. Call 908-691-2608 or visit hempusa.org. It's a great way to change your life. So call 908-691-2608 or visit us at hempusa.org today.
Christopher Knight, talking about his research, his books. Many of you will know him as the author of The Hiram Key, Uriel's Machine, as well as The Book of Hiram, Solomon's Power Brokers, and his most recent book, or current book, shall I say, that's coming out in October, is called Before the Pyramids. And so we're going to be talking about that in the next half an hour. So, Christopher, can you Can you tell me a bit about your new book?
Well, it's strange that it's already out in the U.S. It's not out in the U.K. yet. I don't know why. It sort of came out early over there. All of my books are following the same vein of research, even though they seem quite different sometimes. I mean, like the subject of the Shroud of Turin, but it does link into the Templars, and they all sort of link together. But the this new book is sort of a culmination of the last 10 years of research, I guess. There was another book you didn't mention, the Civilization One, which came out in 2004, which was a sort of interim stage of the research, because I'd been dragged back following the route of where this information had come from way before the beginnings of Jewish state and Solomon and David and even Moses, and way back before to the Egyptians and Sumerians, and then back again to the late Stone Age in the British Isles. And the main ritual of Freemasonry, which I consider the main one, the third degree, the raising of the Master Mason, is the same essentially ritual that was used in some of the major megalithic sites in the British Isles, such as Newgrange in Ireland, which is from 3200 BC, and the same belief in the power of Venus and resurrection, which is central to that degree, was used then. They believed that people could be reincarnated if the bones of the deceased were put with a pregnant woman who was giving birth, and at that time, all the women gave birth at Christmas, because they were all impregnated at the spring festival. Sounds very strange, but the Romans reported they were still doing it when they arrived in the British Isles. So there was this real belief, which is still in the heart of Freemasonry. So I was studying what was known about, and there isn't a huge amount, about these people that inhabited the western fringes of Europe, British Isles in particular, sort of 5,000 years ago. And the main finding, the most important finding, had come from a professor of engineering at Oxford University, who had spent 50 years of his life surveying over 1,000 sites. And he was an engineer, obviously, and he found that they were using a unit or a series of measurements, a system of measurements that were incredibly accurate. You know, the thickness of a piece of paper was too thick for them. You know, they were working to accuracies that we just wouldn't work to today. And you look at some Stonehenge and you think it's all rough and ready, but Stonehenge was very late, actually. This is a long time before then. And so I was looking at the origin of this unit, the base unit he called the megalithic yard. And with fellow researcher Alan Butler, I started to look where this had come from. And we managed to identify it, because our first thought was that if these people had used this unit, which was incredibly accurate, and they couldn't just have measuring sticks, it was too accurate, they must have taken something from nature. So we soon sort of worked out that there was only one thing in nature that could deliver that, and that's the spinning of the Earth, which is the movement of the stars across the sky. Because, of course, the stars aren't moving across the sky, it's just the turning of the Earth. Now, that is so regular that you can time it with a pendulum. And by the nature of pendulums, you can then turn that into a unit of length, because pendulums, anything that determines the swing of a pendulum is its length. And interestingly, Thomas Jefferson worked all this out when, before he was president, and he was trying to create a new system of measures for the new nation of the United States. And he worked, we found out later, exactly the same logic, and he used pendulums and he watched the stars, and he ended up reinventing the whole ancient system a system that fully integrated with it perfectly, because in ancient times they used 366 degrees in a circle, and if you took one of Thomas Jefferson's furlongs and times 366 squared, you got exactly the circumference of the Earth, because is based on the turning of the earth. He didn't know that, but he was just a brilliant man that he just reconnected with the ancients. But having said that, he did also say that as he looked at the ancient British units, he said they came from somewhere deep, deep, deep in antiquity, and they were the product of some ancient science, not of haphazard chance. So, you know, he did a fantastic job. But we were looking at this scientific system of measurement, because they knew the circumference of the Earth 6,000 years ago. They knew how to measure the circumference of the Earth at any given latitude. They knew the polar circumference, but they knew at any latitude it gets wider as you go to the equator and narrower as you get to the pole. They knew how to measure that with huge accuracy. And they laid out all their sites around the British Isles by creating henges, originally circular, huge circular earthworks that were artificial horizons to measure and time the rising and setting of stars. And they conducted wonderful experiments, they located all of their key places at the most crucial places. One, for example, the three henges that are in North Yorkshire are exactly one-tenth of the Earth's circumference from the North Pole. They knew that. And they built these three henges, which are these three giant circles. Each of them, you know, could hold a major cathedral several times over for observing the stars. And they laid them out in the form of Orion's belt, which they measured from the sky and they laid down on the ground. And then 1,000 years later, the Egyptians copied it, and they created pyramids in the same format. But for those, for their pyramids, they came to these henges in England to do the astronomical observations. They went back to Egypt and built their pyramids. And we know that because of the dimensions and the spaces between them. It could not have been done in Egypt. So here we have these Stone Age people, 1,000 years before the pyramids, working out these phenomenal... they knew the speed of light. You know, they actually worked in meters and seconds before they started using a second system. Now, that sounds crazy, but it isn't, because the Sumerians also used it 4,500 years ago. And the French sort of reinvented it. So the meter and the second of time are hugely, hugely ancient, and they're based on the speed of light, believe it or not. So we're talking about people being highly advanced here, and yet they were Stone Age. So Alan Butler himself came to the conclusion that this could not have been the birth of these ideas. They must have been reinventing something from some group that was far more sophisticated than them, and they'd been told the techniques for reconstructing them. So we're looking at something that's far more ancient than even 6,000 years old. But the astonishing bit for the new book came when I was asked to do a History Channel program on the Founding Fathers, which has just recently been screened. I was asked to do this earlier in the year. And for that, I was sort of looking at Washington, D.C. On Google Earth. And before going over to Washington, I thought, I stayed in a really nice place in Georgetown. I wonder if I can spot it on Google Earth. And so I sort of scanned up from the White House area up towards Georgetown, and I stopped because there was this big circle, and I thought, that looks like a henge. It can't be, of course, but I measured it, and my gosh, it's pretty exactly the right size. And so I looked it up, and it was built by the U.S. Navy in the 1850s. But it is a henge because they built it for exactly the same reasons that the ancient ones built in the British Isles were built, in that there was an artificial horizon, they would time stars, and it would help them build nautical charts and understand the nature of the globe better. So it was exactly a henge. But that made me look at Washington, D.C. In more depth, and I sort of started looking at the original plan and just measured a few things, and suddenly it dawned on me that absolutely everything is measured out, not in yards or even in meters or anything else you want to name. It's measured out in megalithic degrees, exactly like Stonehenge or these engines in the British Isles, it uses the megalithic yard, and the megalithic degree is a subset of the circumference of the Earth, where they had 366 megalithic yards to a megalithic circle in the arc. It sounds all a bit technical, but basically they were using them completely integer between all of the original key points. That didn't make any sense. Apart from, the only answer was that there was some continuation of the knowledge. Now, I was talking on television about the Founding Fathers and how George Washington was a member of the Star Families and the importance of Franklin and the Freemasonry, the effect on them all. And you suddenly start to feel, was Washington a sonic experiment to create a new Jerusalem? And they're using this ancient knowledge that they've got, recreating these measures that haven't been used since the time of Stonehenge, because it's perfect, you know, absolutely perfect. It's not the road's alignment, and it's actually the distance between the points. And the absolute center, Washington, D.C., absolute center, is at the center of the ellipse, which is part of the President's Park, south of the White House. And everything radiates from there. Now, what it turned really, really strange when, with Alan Butler, we started measuring modern structures. The Pentagon, for example. And the Pentagon is pure Stone Age British megalithic structure. It's a five-sided figure built inside a circle, and between each point is exactly 366 megalithic yards, exactly as we would find at any prehistoric site. All of its dimensions fit, and its positioning from the ellipse to the center of the dome of the Capitol to the center of the Pentagon. As you look from the center of the Pentagon and go out of the main staircase and look across, it's a direct line to the Capitol, to the dome, and then back to the ellipse. And it's exactly 33 seconds of arc between them. And the knowledge comes from the 33 degrees of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. Now, how does the Pentagon come to be in that position? So if we start to look at it, and of course, some people may know, it was originally planned to be about a mile further north in Roslyn. And some came along and said, no, that's not the right place. They raised an objection. It ought to be further south in a place called Hell's Bottom, which was probably well named at the time. It was not a very nice place. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt, then president, said, yep, that's right. And by the way, I want it looking like this. And he, as a bit of an amateur architect, specified its shape, its orientation, its place. Now, we looked up who raised the objection. Well, it was his cousin, called Delano. And they're both 33rd degree Freemasons. Very clearly, this was all done at the behest of the 33rd degree of Freemasonry. I've spent years and years on radio and TV, particularly in the West, saying there is no Masonic conspiracy. It's not a conspiracy as such, but it has been done in secret. So, but for good reasons, not for bad. It appears that they're building the city of God here. They're using God's own measure from time immemorial, from 6,000 years ago. And the actual layout of the Pentagon is described in the 32nd and 33rd degrees of Freemasonry. How the Pentagon is the symbol of power of the five armies, and how within it sits a triangle. And you draw a triangle as exactly as it describes, and it delineates the inner wall of the five walls of the Pentagon. And all this through the President of the United States, who was a 33rd degree Freemason. And structures that have been built since, even within this century, fall perfectly, use integer measures of megalithic seconds of arc. The plan is going on, and they're not telling anybody. But the really interesting thing is that the ellipse, which is the natural center of Washington, D.C., which is unmarked. No one thinks about it much these days. They used to have a marker. In the 1870s, when they were building the ellipse, the army engineers that were building it were told exactly what they had to do, but they weren't allowed to get involved in something in the center because there was an excavation going on there, which they were told was something to do with drains. I believe that they were digging a chamber to contain extremely important artifacts moved from under the Temple of Jerusalem that were put there in 70 AD, that were removed in 1128 by the Knights Templar, that were taken to Scotland in 1140, that were buried under Roslin Chapel in the 1340s, 50, sorry, 1440s or 1450, and subsequently moved when they were doing the rebuilding of Roslin, at the same time as they were building this chamber in this new Jerusalem, the capital of the United States of America. And I think beneath there is the golden triangle of Enoch, which according to Masonic legend and other legend was ancient at the time of Solomon. They found it in the chamber when they were clearing the ground to build King Solomon's temple. They found it, an ancient chamber there that contained this artifact. And I think, I really believe, it's beneath the ellipse in Washington, D.C. And everything in Washington radiates from that divine object. Now, strangely, Dan Brown's new book's just come out talking about Freemasonic conspiracies in Washington, D.C., and having scan read it, it doesn't add up to a great deal in my view, but the reality is far, far stranger than any fiction. And the beauty is anyone can go on Google Earth and just check it out. And if you buy Before the Pyramids, it shows you exactly what we mean, and you can just check it out, see if we're right, see if we're wrong. And just notice how nothing fails to fit. It's like a magic blueprint. These people, whoever they are, know exactly what they're doing. Now, I contacted a friend of mine who is a 33rd degree Freemason. He's a big-time lawyer in Iowa. And I asked him to explain to me the structure of the 33rd degree, because I know quite a lot about most of Freemasonry, but the higher end of the 33rd degree is just a little bit secret if you can't find out much about that. Now, I'd heard that being a 33rd degree Freemason was unusual honor, and only 1% of people that make the 32nd degree actually get to be the 33rd degree. But even then, that's only honorary. There are only 30, in the southern jurisdiction, there are only 33 men at any given time who are really 33rd degree. And so I asked my friend, well, how do they make decisions? He said, well, it's not a democracy like the rest of Freemasonry. They just dictate downwards, but they're told what to think, and they're not allowed to debate. Well, who tells them this? Well, we don't really know. So, this, and the president, you know, Delano Roosevelt was beneath this when the Pentagon was being built. So we're talking about exercising of some incredible power. Now, I don't for a second suggest that there's any bad will in it or any evil intent at all. Not far from it. I think they're trying to build the new Jerusalem, the new capital of the world. I think that is the new world order. That is what they want, and they mean order, goodness. But they're not telling anybody. And I personally feel, having done the detective work to find this, that they should be explaining themselves and persuading us, not just doing it. So I'm really intrigued to see how they're going to respond to this.
So if there is a conspiracy, then it's obviously mainly amongst those that are 33 degree Masons. Is that what you're saying?
And I think even above
the lower levels, the lower levels are not aware of this conspiracy.
I think even the 33rd degree are, the vast majority of them are not aware of it. We're talking about a very, very senior elite. And people have said that to me in the past. They said, oh, you don't know, you're too junior, they haven't told you. And I said, oh, I don't think so. That's a bit conspiratorial, a bit silly. Now I had to sort of say, I appear to have been wrong. It is here. You can call it a conspiracy insofar as there are a small group of people acting together and not telling anybody else, but it's not a conspiracy insofar as I don't think they're trying to get any personal advantage from it. They're trying to help everybody. So it's a benign conspiracy, if it is one at all. So I certainly don't want to feed the minds of anti-Freemasons. But equally, I think in this day and age, there is a rightfulness in openness. Perhaps there didn't used to be. Maybe it was okay in times gone by, but I think it's time to come clean a little bit.
Well, what is your next step in uncovering this conspiracy?
Well, the book wasn't even supposed to be out yet, but I see it's available on Amazon, unbeknown to me. So I was waiting for this to take effect and then discuss it in the media. Because I know if I go to the Scottish Rite and ask them to discuss it, they won't. So the power of publicity is the only way to bring this into the open. And for masses of people to check it out themselves. You know, so it's not just some weird theory where you've got to know about astrology and astronomy, and it's not that. It's just you just measure all these key points. You know, because on Google Earth or similar programs, you can get very, very accurate measurements and confirm it and say, does that happen by chance? And then look at the people involved and the big finger points at the Scottish Rite. Mm-hmm. And so I think they've got some discussion to have. Unfortunately, you know, I don't want to be making life hard for them, but this has to be discussed, in my view.
Well, have you come across anybody yet associated with Freemasonry that seems to be at all aware of this conspiracy?
No, because the most senior people I know are 33rd degree, but only honorary 33rd degree. I've met others who are fully 33rd degree, but not in recent times. I mean, it's only this year I've found this information out. So, no, I haven't, and it's very early days. And I really think there probably is only a handful. My feeling is Freemasonry has been a conduit for, it's only been in existence since the mid-15th century as Freemasonry, but the rituals are hugely ancient and were used by the Knights Templar before, but once the Knights Templar were disbanded, they went in different directions, but Freemasonry was created by the Sinclairs of Roslyn using the old rituals. Because they'd got all the documents and treasures from the temple underneath Roslyn. And they had a duty to protect them. And when these star families had entered the church and took control of the church originally, which gave them the power to do the things that they needed to do. But when the Reformation came, and we have Protestants, the church was no longer the single source of controlling people. So they had to fairly rapidly invent a new mechanism that would take people of different religions and bring them together, which is what Freemasonry has always been about. It's about people of different religions coming together, influential people. So you can control them through this new structure, and we give them the rituals, and we tell them it's got to be kept secret originally. So I think it was created deliberately as a conduit for this ancient knowledge. But in recent times, over the last century, it's been in decline. And I suspect that these families behind it, the star families, are slowly withdrawing from it or working outside of it. And the Freemasonry, even the Scottish Rite at the top end, itself is only one arm of whatever is going on there. You know, I'm just starting to sense that there is something that is outside of mainstream politics and outside of mainstream Freemasonry that has got a guiding hand on the tiller. Now, I don't suspect for a second that George W. Bush or our current president is aware of this whatsoever. I'm sure they're not, and they're certainly not 33rd degree Freemason. That's part of Freemasonry losing its power. But certainly, on 9/11/41, when the Pentagon was built, that was absolutely driven by 33rd degree Freemasonry. It's the embodiment of their ritual, and it's the embodiment of megalithic structures in Europe absolutely perfect in every detail.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot more research that can occur around this.
I think we've dealt the lid on it. There's a lot more.
I'd like to have you on again in the future, and we can talk about latest updates of what more you've learned about it, if you've done any more research, if you've actually gone to Washington, D.C. I am a treasure hunter. I love this kind of search and research. So I hope you can come back on a future date and we can talk some more. But our time has run out for today, and it was really a great pleasure to have you on the show today, Christopher. And I've learned a lot, and I know that everyone else has learned a lot. So and excellent. Good luck with your book. I'm sure it's going to be very impactful from what little you've told us today. Extremely impactful.
Good to speak to you, Mark.
Great. Yeah, likewise. And as I said, Christopher is going to be speaking at the conference in Italy next April, a conference to unite the secret societies, and he's going to be sharing more of his book at that point. Next week on the show, we have Andrew Sinclair, another Brit, coming on, and we're going to be talking a lot about Roslyn Chapel and the mysteries around it. And Andrew, some of you might know, is the only one that's actually gone down into the crypt in modern times. So we're going to be hearing all about that next week. So until then, have a wonderful week, and always remember that the Holy Grail is right inside of you. Bye for now.